Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Greg Olson has supported Independent Tech News directly for 5 years. Want to be like Craig? Become a DTNS member at patreon.com/DTNS.
This is the Daily Tech News for Friday, April 5th, 2019 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
And from Studio Feline, I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Chain.
Len Peralta will not be illustrating this week. He had some technical difficulties, but he will return next week. We are joined, though, by Laura Shin, host of the Unchained podcast and Unconfirmed podcast, and somebody who covers the Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, blockchain space very well. Laura, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me again. I'm glad to be here.
It was kind of a busy week in your area of the news. So we've got a lot to talk about.
Yes. Yes. Tell me about it. I was working like morning till night every day for various reasons.
There's some SEC guidelines to talk about. We're going to ask Laura where she thinks this whole space is as far as Bitcoin and blockchain. But let's start with a few tech things you should know.
The Wall Street Journal sources say that Apple Music reached 28 million paid subscribers in February, which passes Spotify with 26 million. However, if you include the free tier, Spotify has more users than Apple Music in the U.S., and it still has more paid subscribers worldwide. The reports also claim that Apple Music's worldwide growth is higher than Spotify's overall.
Google announced the dissolution of the Advanced Technology External Advisory Council, the AI ethics thing we told you about last week. Well, it's already gone. Google employees petitioned for the removal of Heritage Foundation President K. Cole James. Then Carnegie Mellon's Alessandro Acquisti resigned. So Google said it became clear the council couldn't function properly, and it, quote, will find different ways of getting outside opinions on these topics.
A pilot program from Google puts a row of advertisements on Android TV device home screens. A Sony support page says, quote, the purpose is to help you discover new apps and contents for your TV. Sony says it's managed by Google and can't be customized. XDA developers report seeing the strip in Sony Smart TVs, the Mi Box 3, and NVIDIA Shield TVs as well.
Can't imagine anyone will mind, right?
No.
Finally, China's TikTok app is launching a talent contest where users from Japan and Korea can upload music videos to be judged by local musicians and people from record labels. Become the next K-pop or J-pop star. A combination of popularity and judges' opinions will narrow the field to 18 over the next 5 months. TikTok says 5 to 10 acts will eventually be crowned winners at the end of the season, which includes getting a record deal, I think. All right, let's talk a little bit more about what the European Commission is doing to Steam.
Let's do that. The European Commission sent statements of objections to Valve, Bandai Namco, Capcom, Focus Home, Koch Media, ZeniMax, if that wasn't enough for you, saying that it believes geo-blocking Steam purchases violates Article 101. That article regards the digital single market, and geo-blocking prevents cross-border sales in some EU member countries. After an investigation, the European Commission could ban the behavior and fine companies up to 10% of their annual worldwide turnover, which could be a lot.
If you're not familiar with how this works, it could be a little bit tricky to understand. They're not saying that if you buy a game and you live in Poland and you travel to Japan, that you should be able to play it. They're saying if you buy a game and live in Poland and you travel to Germany, you should be able to play it. Because what Valve is doing with Steam right now is geo-blocking by countries within the EU. And the EU has this digital single market initiative to try to get rid of those kinds of geo-blocking. For instance, with Netflix as well, to say like, hey, if you subscribe to Netflix, you should be able to get access to your subscription no matter where you are in Europe. And that means your own home library, not just the Netflix that's available in France, say, if you're a German subscriber, et cetera. So it'll be interesting to see if these companies and Valve come to an agreement with the European Commission somehow, because unlike Google, which likes to fight these things because it's a much bigger deal, I think Steam would just like to make this go away, and they'll need the cooperation of these publishers to do it. In preliminary Q1 earnings, Samsung reported operating income fell 60% on the year, the biggest decline since Q3 2014, and below analyst estimates. Samsung had issued a warning last month that they thought the income would come short due to decreases in DRAM and NAND memory prices as a result of slowing sales. DRAM demand is expected to rise, however, in the second half of the year as data centers work through their existing inventory, so that could be good news for Samsung. Samsung display divisions were also hurt by lower than expected iPhone sales and competition from Chinese display makers.
Yeah, we've been talking about the fact that Samsung had said, all right, brace yourselves, not going to be a great quarter. But the numbers are grim, particularly since it hasn't been that big of a decline since back in 2014, 5 years ago. But again, this is one of these kind of cyclical things that I wonder, how much are we going to be talking about this in the fall? It made even out the way that many quarterly earnings do for companies. But because Samsung does depend on other companies, the iPhone sales being a really big factor in this, for example, if trends start to go in other directions for other companies, which are even technically competitors of Samsung, then I'd love to see what Q4 looks like for the company this year.
Yeah, Samsung's really complex. For instance, the Galaxy S10 was on sale during Samsung's Q1, but it is expected to continue to sell well enough to sort of boost the mobile revenues. At the same time, the display part of Samsung's business would like the iPhone to do well. They need the Samsung Galaxy S10 and the iPhone to do well, as well as any other clients they have. And don't forget that Samsung has other divisions as well. They have financial divisions. They have white good divisions, things like washers and dryers. But the big money tends to come these days from display panels, memory, and phones. And so the big drag has been that large amount of money they got from memory has stagnated as the market has stalled. And yeah, like you said, Sarah, if it loosens up at the end of the year, if iPhone sales are pretty good, then Samsung could have a pretty good looking Q4. Laura, I'm actually curious, do you care to declare if you use an iPhone, Android, or some other phone?
I use an iPhone, but I often will give out a Google Voice phone number for security reasons, which goes back to a crazy trend that's been happening in the crypto space now for a few years. I wrote about it all the way back in 2016, but scammers will like steal your phone number through, you know, like if mm-hmm. you're at Sprint or whatever, they'll call and be like, so let's say I'm your hacker, I'll call AT&T and say, hey, I'm Tom. I want to move my service over to Sprint. And then once all of your calls and texts are coming to my phone, I will like lock you out all of your accounts. And the reason this is happening to crypto people is that like if they can break into your Coinbase account or something, then they can like send the Bitcoin out and there's no bank of Bitcoin that can reverse the transaction. So long answer to your question, but yes, I use an iPhone.
and yet there are reasons to sort of protect that phone. That's really good insight. I don't know. Is there a preferred operating system in the cryptocurrency space?
Well, I think a lot of people are doing what I'm doing where the reason I explained that was because if you text me, it will look like it's like not an iMessage because it's like a Google Voice text. Mm-hmm. But I think what's happening is like essentially whatever kind of phone you have in the crypto space, you will use Google Voice. So it depends on how technical you are. I think the more techie types, they use the Google phones.
A study published in Psychological Science by scientists from the University of Oxford found little evidence of a link between time spent on devices by teenagers and general well-being. We've talked about this a lot on the show in the past. The study combined self-reporting and time diaries, which records what teens are doing at certain times of the day and also where they are. Data was used from 17,000 teens in the UK, the US, and Ireland, collected between 2011 and 2016. Further studies could take into account the type of content being viewed as well, which I think would be the logical next question. Okay, if you're, you know, if you're doing great, I mean, are you hanging out on real positive networks, or yeah, I think that matters a lot into something like this.
Yeah, if you're generally seeing the data say, okay, there doesn't seem to be a strong link between the general well-being and the amount of time spent, is there a link to be found in that data between the people who are not doing so well and the kind of content they're looking for, particularly if they're looking at violent content, et cetera? I'm not trying to assume that there's a link there, but that would be a logical thing to look at, especially as countries like we heard about from Australia are really trying to crack down on certain types of content even being allowed onto platforms. You know, we should know what kind of effect that has and do some studies on it. But Roger, as you know, you've got two kids. How does this strike you?
It's an interesting study, and I think really what it highlights is that There isn't a comprehensive, definitive study that says this explains everything, right? This is yet another study in this ongoing research to find some sort of correlative data between screen time and adolescent health. And, you know, it depends on, you know, if you're just looking at screen time and then like the overall health of the individual, you glean certain things. But for example, if you do a study on children with like emotional issues like depression, and then you study the amount of screen time, you'll come up with different correlative data. And really it's building a study that kind of answers what you're looking for. I mean, there's so many ways to you guys have just covered so many ways to look at it that I think this will help build a picture, but it doesn't help complete the overall picture of what we need to do. But I will say, as a parent, it does relieve me some of the guilt.
one more study to help relieve the guilt.
More screen time does not equal sadder children.
I mean, I think it does help complete the picture. It just doesn't complete the picture.
Yeah, exactly. It's one more piece in the giant puzzle that we are trying to build between screen time. I mean, like, we've been doing this for decades with television and children. Like, you know, when I was in school, TV's going to rot your brain. You're going to go blind. If you watch it in the dark, you watch too much, you're going to have a stupid idea. You know, there are all these things that came out of it, which turned out to be more of a symptomatic. Like, they were watching a lot of TV because it was a symptom of something else that was going on with that individual, not necessarily the cause of whatever. And so what we need is longer, you know, we need more studies over a longer period of time to give us, you know, a yet another brick to kind of build out this giant picture.
Yeah, that's why it's good this study did more than just self-reporting. Self-reporting can sometimes overestimate at one end and underestimate at the other.
Self-reporting is always a 50-50, especially when they found out that everyone who filled in one of those dietary things about how much they ate and how much they weighed and you know their physical health.
Tons of examples of that.
Bloomberg's
Mark Gurman reports his sources say Amazon will launch a pair of wireless Bluetooth earbuds with voice integration in the second half of 2019. So you'll get good old Alex A in your head. The device will reportedly look similar to Apple's AirPods, have a USB charging case like the AirPods and others like it, and let users tap to answer calls and change tracks. So it's basically what you would expect from a Jabra or AirPod or Google, except made by Amazon. Current test units are in black or gray, although who knows what they'll end up being in, but it sounds like maybe they're testing some colors out there for them. Sarah, you're living with the Jabras right now. How enticing are these Amazon earbuds?
I think it very much depends on price. I will say that Jabra, which is the model is the Jabra Elite 65T, which technically integrates with both Siri and Alexa, and you can toggle between the two. I have not found that to be very seamless. That'll be part of a report that I'll be making pretty soon. But I think if Amazon wants the voice assistant to become a bigger player against Google's assistant, which is huge in the mobile space, then this is the right way to go. I don't know how great these speakers or these speakers, these earbuds are going to sound, but it's not that hard to make good sounding earbuds these days. The Jabras that I have are over $150. What if Amazon does something similar for $99? Mm-hmm. Gesture stuff, pretty enticing as well. Again, I have found anything with a Bluetooth connection to my phone can be squirrely. It's not just earbuds. It's lots of things.
It's just Bluetooth. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just Bluetooth, but it is getting better. And I think that, you know, Amazon doesn't create competition, and say we're the high end company. No, they're really successful because they do pretty good stuff for prices that most of the time people consider really affordable. So it seems like a really good move on their part.
Yeah, Gurman's article too says that the sources are saying Amazon wants these to sound better than the AirPods. So if they could do that and be cheaper, then that is kind of a slam dunk. Laura, before we move off this, I'm curious if you use any of these kind of wireless earbuds for your work.
Yeah, I use AirPods. But one thing I was wondering is, wait, so I'm sorry, it's connected to Alexa somehow?
Yeah, so that's built into the earbuds, according to the sources, anyway.
Oh,
so
meaning like you could listen to music
in your ear, you'd right. tap it and
so
say.
Instead of you being like, I have to be near my speaker in my living room, it would just be part of your life wherever you are.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I don't know. I don't trust Alexa. I don't trust any of those home listening device. Like, I would never have one of those in my home listening to me all the time.
But you wouldn't have to have one of them in your house. It would just be in the earbuds. So
yeah, you could just use. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I know.
Although you could make the same argument. They're still listening.
Sure.
Just walking
Wait,
around.
Your earbuds are listening to you? No, they're not.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission issued guidelines this week for companies that want to sell digital tokens. The SEC considers most cryptocurrencies an investment contract. That means they should be considered securities and registered with the SEC before being offered to the public. The SEC guidelines do say that Bitcoin and Ethereum both are not securities because they're decentralized. In a separate letter this week, Turnkey Jet was also allowed to offer unregistered tokens because the proceeds would not be used to build that token network, and then the tokens would not trade outside of Turnkey's platform. Laura, I know this is very much in your wheelhouse, and in fact, you suggested this story for us today, although there's a couple different stories in here. What are your thoughts on how people are trying to define all of this stuff going forward?
What came out this week is actually not that different from what different members of the SEC have been saying all along. However, what is different is that now it's been codified into this document, whereas before they were generally comments by, for instance, the SEC chairman or different directors of the SEC that they made in like speeches or at conferences. And so, people were just like trying to parse what they were saying all the time and trying to figure out how official is what they're saying. And then now that it's actually come out, it's a pretty kind of like a full analysis of how securities law would apply. Whereas like before, it was literally just maybe like a sentence here or there where then people were trying to extrapolate. So it definitely made a lot of waves. However, in terms of the actual significance, there's nothing that's really new. There are like small pieces. But in terms of the overall gist, it's been kind of what different individuals have been saying from the SEC all along.
It does seem like that's one of the frustrations people are having is they pointed to a 1946 Supreme Court decision on investment contracts rather than saying, hey, this is a whole new thing. We're going to have to come up with whole new rules for it.
Exactly. And like I said, they've been saying that all along. You know, 2 years ago now, they came out with kind of their first quote unquote report that applied to the space. It was called the Dow Report, which addressed, I don't know if you remember back in 2016, the Dow, this decentralized autonomous organization that was structured like a venture fund, and it raised $150 million in a crowd sale. Eventually, it went defunct anyway because there was a bug in the code that enabled somebody to take $50 million. And so that's how we now have two versions of Ethereum. Ethereum was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, we need to fix this. And so they hard forked the ledger. And so there's now what we call Ethereum is now a version of Ethereum where none of this happened. And then the original chain now goes by Ethereum Classic. But anyway, the point is, okay, so after a year after all that pandemonium, the SEC came out with its first report called this the Dow Report. And at that time, they said the law that applies here is this so-called Howey test, which comes out of the Supreme Court case. And you're right, the original case involves orange groves of all things. And so this report this week was the first time where, like, you know, what they released actually, you know, if you read between the lines, they don't use the words like minors or anything like that. But, you know, it very clearly kind of shows like, okay, so these are the ways that they view the Howey test. And here, when they're like describing how that would apply in this case, you can figure out, oh, they're talking about like how it would apply to miners, how it would apply to developers of these projects, things like that. And so in that regard, it was like a little bit more meat for people who want to do projects in this space where they can have more to look at, to think about when they launch something.
I do like the idea of harvesting Bitcoin instead of mining it. You know, picking it off.
Yeah, well, there's another project they call theirs baking. So because one of the guys
sounds good.
Yeah, one of the guys who started it is French. So he was like, you know what? If we can make up our own words, I'm going to choose baking.
Might as well. Yeah. Folks, if you want to get all the tech headlines each day in about 5 minutes, y'all need to subscribe to dailytechheadlines.com. It's available to keep you up to date. All right. The P2P Foundation's profile for Bitcoin creator Satoshi Nakamoto lists the date of birth as April 5th, 1975. We don't know who Satoshi Nakamoto is or if this birthday is accurate, but hey, why not? Happy birthday, Satoshi. Quickly, while we have Laura here, we do want to touch on Bitcoin. Bitcoin trading volume dropped to a two-year low in March. However, earlier this week, the coin rebounded with a 20% rise, having its best day since 2017. Nobody seems to agree why that happened. But let's cut to the chase. Laura, is Bitcoin dead?
Oh my gosh, no. Bitcoin is definitely not dead. You know, will it survive long time? Like, I don't know. You know, certainly I think something in the crypto space will, but just look at this. Like a few years ago, you know, people were paying 10,000 Bitcoins to order two pizzas, and now a single Bitcoin is like 5,000 or whatever it is. So clearly this is not dead. And there's a significant number of people around the world who believe in it to the point where, you know, they're putting their quote unquote savings in what they call this digital gold. And so for them, like, you know, they think this is a superior form of money. Frankly, I think, and I don't know if I would only restrict it to Bitcoin, but, you know, crypto assets in general, I find to be a superior form of money compared to cash, seashells, credit cards, like whatever you want to call it. So in that regard, like, like I said, I don't know if Bitcoin will succeed long term, but is it dead? Definitely not.
All right, let's talk about DeFi or decentralized finance, which is, as I understand it, sort of another layer being used to sort of bridge the gap and sort of hedge yourself against some of the volatility, but take advantage of some of the independence of blockchain and cryptocurrency. Explain to us a little bit what DeFi is.
So this is a trend I've been following now for about a year in the crypto space, and it's mostly happening on Ethereum. So the examples I'll give you are from Ethereum. But essentially, if you look at our current financial system, and this goes back to the financial crisis, you know, people became disillusioned with the way our current system works because it's these, you know, big institutions that just have all this power and take a lot of the money. And when things like Bitcoin and blockchain technologies were introduced, it introduced this idea also that now you could have these sort of like community owned networks where people own a piece of it. And rather than this central gatekeeper, like a bank saying, okay, you know, I'll take your money or I'll lend you money, you know, or, you know, to other people, I won't do that for you. Now you could replace all that with software, right? So what a lot of these DeFi, decentralized finance projects, are doing is they're essentially replicating a lot of the banking functions using smart contracts on Ethereum. So for instance, we've got decentralized lending, we've got decentralized derivatives, decentralized credit, decentralized exchange. These are all kind of different examples of some of the things that these developers are building. And I'm actually going to walk you through this one example that I just find so fascinating. And it is, I think, not only fascinating to me, but to a lot of people, because it actually makes up, I forget, it's something like maybe 75% of all DeFi at the moment. It actually accounts for now for 2% of all Ethereum is locked up in this system.
Interesting.
And what's fascinating about it is that it's actually kind of multiple things at once. And so the system is called MakerDAO. And originally, most people, like, you know, if you just kind of ask somebody who maybe has a passing familiarity with it, they'll think, oh, MakerDAO creates the stable coin called DAI. Mm-hmm. And a stable coin is any kind of cryptocurrency that has a stable value similar to a dollar. And in this case, DAI is indeed pegged to the value of a dollar. But the way that they make this peg happen is different from other stable coins. You have centralized versions of stable coins where maybe they partner with a bank or multiple banks or whatever, and then there's a dollar in the bank for every digital dollar that they're issuing, right? MakerDAO is a decentralized version of a stablecoin where instead of having dollars in a bank sitting anywhere where, you know, that it poses like a certain kind of risk, right? Because then there are individual institutions that could be hacked or whatever. You can go on there with your Ether and you can create stable coins. You can create DAI for yourself. And the way that this works is you basically give yourself a loan. So let's say you have, this is the funny thing about doing these podcasts. I actually don't keep track of the prices very well because I tend to focus more on the technology. But so let's say, I'm actually not sure what the price of Ether is right now.
We can imagine one. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's say it's like $100.
Sure.
So let's say you have like 10 Ether or something, like $1,000. And you're like, okay, well, you know, I expect the value of Ether to go up. Maybe, you know, in a year, I think it might be at like 150 or 200. So I'd like to kind of use the money now without actually selling the Ether. So I'm going to put, and we'll just keep the numbers easy. So maybe you put like 1.5 of your Ether you put three of your Ether in the MakerDAO smart contract, and then that will enable you to take out, and actually I might be doing this wrong. Sorry. It might be, so we'll say 1.5 Ether, and then you're allowed to take out $100 worth of DAI because you have to over collateralize. It's, I think, 150%. And then you can spend that money. You can like spend those dollars and yeah. Okay. Or the DAI, sorry, I shouldn't call them dollars. And okay. Yeah. Later you'll have to pay kind of like a quote unquote interest rate, which is actually called the DAI stability fee, which is used to make certain functions happen. So that way, indeed, you know, the system can kind of keep going and they can pay the various people who make it happen. Enables you to use that cash. So instead of like, you know, like with a stock, you would just have to wait for it to go up to use it, right? Or to use the value in it. In this case, you can sort of have your cake and eat it too, where yes, you get to hopefully enjoy the price appreciation in the Ether, but at the same time, you can sort of use the dollars for, you know, I don't know, buying a coffee or whatever it might be.
So where are the dollars in this transaction?
So that's the DAI.
Yeah.
So that's when you take out the DAI, because the DAI is supposed to be pegged to a dollar. Mm-hmm. You can use the DAI to...
But how is it pegged to a dollar if you're buying it with Ethereum? I think that's the part that's tripping me up.
Right. Okay. So this is where it gets tricky.
Uh-huh.
So there is actually a second token in the MakerDAO system, and that's called MKR.
Okay.
And the MKR, that the value of that goes up and down. That's not pegged to the dollar. And only special... people basically are allowed, well, not special, sorry. They're essentially, that's a, what they call a governance token, where those people, their job is to make sure that the system does not collapse. Their job is to, if any of these, they're called collateralized debt positions when you put up your Ether and then take out DAI. If any of these collateralized debt positions is getting too low, where it's falling below the 150%, then they are they need to kind of pick those off and close out those positions. And then, so like, let's say it's yours, where your CDP was falling below the threshold. So then suddenly your Ether gets sold, and I actually have to, so I'm sorry that I don't remember at this point what happens to you if you just have the dye. Mm-hmm. I think you just have the dye, and then the system, you know, will try to ensure that the value of the system never falls below the collateral, you know, across the whole system.
What's their motivation to do that on the MKR side?
So for the MKR holders, if they do a good job and the peg does not fall and the system does retain its peg, then they, I can't remember at what point, but at some point, some of the MKR tokens will get burnt. Mm. And so what that means is then the value should go up. However, if they don't do a good job, then more MKR tokens will be minted in order to make the system whole again.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So anyway, all of this is to say, this is basically like a decentralized central bank.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so people are going on there, they're creating DAI for themselves, and then they're additionally using the DAI to purchase more Ether. like this is where it gets, this is why I was saying there's echoes of the financial crisis.
Right.
And then on top of that, they're also doing it on other DeFi projects where you can put DAI in and then earn an interest rate on it. So like, you know, they could have the price appreciation with the Ether on the one hand, but then they get the DAI and then they can put it in it's like a decentralized money market called Compound, where I think the interest rate, at least for some period, was 6%. And then they would put the DAI into Compound and then earn the 6% additionally. So there's just all kinds of like super interesting. Yeah, I hope that wasn't too complicated for people to follow.
It's going to be real complicated for a lot of folks to follow. But I think if we can sum it up, it sounds like what's happening with DeFi and DAO, this MakerDAO being an example of that, is instead of just a currency system, a transactional currency system, you're creating a banking system. And it's more than just your local branch bank. It's like the full financial.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
...industry is what they're attempting. Does that sound about right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, that's really it. Because like I said, I'm seeing projects in all these categories. We've got the money markets, we've got the derivatives, we've got the lenders, you know, just, I mean, it's like... And yeah, it's fascinating because they're all a decentralized exchange. They're all doing things with each other. So the different DeFi projects, people are using their money in multiple ways across them.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating, and why you folks should subscribe to Unchained and Unconfirmed to learn more about this.
We also hear a lot of these types of stories in our subreddit. You can submit stories and vote on others at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com. Also on Facebook, facebook.com/groups/dailytechnewsshow.
Well, thank you, Laura, for joining us today and kind of introducing us to this topic. I know some folks out there are still going to be, you know, their brain spinning a little, especially if they're not as familiar with the financial industry. But I saw some people in the chat room are like, okay, this sounds like options trading. This, you know, so they're starting to catch on. But at least you now know about the term DeFi and kind of have a slot to put it in if you hear about it or talk about it. And if folks want to find out more about these sort of topics, where should they go?
You can go to unchainedpodcast.com. Both of my podcasts are there. And I also have a weekly newsletter that you can sign up for where you will get all the podcasts plus all the links that I think are important for the week for people to stay abreast of the news in the crypto space.
Go check it out, folks. And you can follow Laura on Twitter at Laura Shin. Also, folks, don't forget you could support this show directly through Patreon. You get all kinds of perks, including a weekly Threatwire cross post from Shannon Morse, a column from Roger, an audio column from me, and more. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/DTNS.
If you've got feedback at dailytechnewsshow.com is the place to send it. We're live Monday through Friday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Thanks, everybody. Joining us live and find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live.
Back on Monday with Vlad Savov from The Verge joining us. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.